So our series begins today on this little title, Ask the Exiles. Well, you know what I'm like by now. When we do character studies, I like to do it through a series of questions. And we've done that with the story of Joseph. We've done that with Moses. And all of the questions in the series of Moses began, Moses, what was it like? And then, of course, we had asked the in-laws in our drive-ins, and we looked at the characters of Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz. Well, the title, I'm sure, has meant something to most of you, but what is an exile? Well, it's someone who is being banished or barred from their native country for some reason or other. In the modern day, it could be political reason, of course, or a punitive reason, or some kind of punishment. The very first exiles we read of are the ones I've mentioned to the boys and girls, Adam and Eve. They were banished from Eden. And that was a punitive reason. That was punishment for what they had done in going against the commandment of God, their rebellion against God. But the group of exiles that we're going to be thinking about in the next few weeks in the will of the Lord is found much later on in Bible history. And I'm bunching them together because their stories are connected through a specific period of time that we usually refer to as the captivity. So who are these people? Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Ezra, Nehemiah, Mordecai, and Hadassah. So there's quite a number. I'm not saying that we're going to be able to do them all or do them all with the same level of scrutiny, but we will definitely touch on them. And these folks lived and were affected by what's known as the captivity or the Babylonian captivity. Unlike some of the other studies, character studies that we've had, like Naomi, who chose to go to Moab, her daughter-in-law Ruth, who chose to go to Bethlehem, Jonah, who chose to go to Tarshish, and Lot, who chose to go to Sodom. These folks in the group called the exiles, they didn't choose this. They found themselves living away from their native homeland under a foreign power as captives as well as exiles. And they were given into the hands of their enemies by their own long-suffering, merciful, loving and gracious God. And the question I would want to use to frame our thoughts this morning is this. What happens when a nation disregards God's laws? The book of Daniel is a fascinating book, and we'll be reading from that in a minute or two. So obviously you're going to get Daniel. But today, please stick with me. It's going to be one of those introductions, and it does take a wee bit of getting our teeth around to set the scene. And the book of Daniel is a fascinating book. And from childhood, many of us have been captivated by the adventures of the character whose name is given to the book. But it's not just a book about a person called Daniel. Nor is it only about him and his friends. Nor is it only about him and his friends and his enemies. It's a book about kingdoms, nations. We would maybe say world powers, if you like. And it contains prophecies about the rise and fall of the greatest of these world powers. And it's in the context of the behavior of nations, kingdoms, that we find the spotlight then moving in the direction of individuals like Daniel and the others we've mentioned. Imagine if the Bible writers had only provided us with the big headlines. The facts surrounding the advancement or the demise of nations. Front page news. Imagine if that's all the writers of the Bible had given us. It'd be a hard old read, wouldn't it? But I love the way our Bible's constructed because in and through that, even some of the weighty books and the prophecies, in and through that, God, because of his amazing wisdom, he has injected these life stories of characters. And we can imagine ourselves there. Well, that's how I work, as you know by now. I try to imagine myself being one of these individuals, trying to imagine myself living in their time. And so what we get in the Word of God is not just the story of nations and God's dealings with them, not just the story of kingdoms, but the story, the human story of individuals who had to live through those times. History of nations fills our head, if you like, but it's the human story of the men and women who lived through those times that fill our hearts. And I hope that's what happens too. Our hearts will be filled as we look at these exiled people. So our question is, what happens when a nation disregards God's law? Well, surely all the Gentile nations disregarded God's law. Well, they didn't even take God's law under their notice. And yet, many of them rose to great prominence and power. But my question is really aimed at the nation that these exiles belonged to. So this is Israel, God's chosen people, the children, family of God, if you like. And that's where our question is directed to. What happens when that nation disregards God's law? Because they were the people who were given God's law. And they're the people with whom God himself entered into covenant relationship. He did that with no other kingdom or nation. Of course, by the time the exiles lived, the nation of Israel was divided. Whenever we were going through our studies in the prophets of Nineveh, to keep things simple, we just talked about the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, because the northern kingdom, you see, comes under the name Israel, and therein you can get confused. And the southern kingdom, of course, was Judah, the larger group, 10 tribes in the north, and a smaller group known as Judah. The northern kingdom had no godly kings, really. And by this, the time that we're dealing with here, they had been conquered by the Assyrians. And we covered that pretty well in our studies in the prophets of Nineveh. But the southern kingdom, where our characters belonged, well, they had a mixture of good and bad kings. And after about 130 years after the northern kingdom had been conquered by the Assyrians, the same fate was about to come to the southern kingdom, also known as Judah. But this time it wouldn't be the Assyrians, it would be the Babylonians. Sometimes they're referred to as the Chaldeans. So I hope you're with me to this point. What happens when a nation disregards God's law? Well, God can't ignore it. And he must take action. And he does take action. We saw what he did with the northern kingdom through the Assyrians. And now, although it's years later, the southern kingdom are going the same way. You think they would have learned. You think they would have observed history and said, well, we don't want to end up like them. But alas, no. And if we go to 2 Chronicles chapter 36, we can see God's action chronicled. That's why the book gets that name. From verse 14, I'll read. Moreover, all the chief of the priests and the people transgressed very much after all the abominations of the heathen. So they weren't following God's law. They were following everything around them. After all the abominations of the heathen, and polluted the house of the Lord, which he had hallowed in Jerusalem. So there we have a record of backsliding and transgression from the top down. The chief of the priests, those described as the unfaithful shepherds, right down to the people as well, of course. So it's a national departure. Verse 15, "And the Lord God of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place." So here we have a record of God's love and mercy in speaking to his people, faithfully warning them. Not only was what happened to the northern kingdom a really dramatic picture study, a living illustration, but God was also coming to them, and through his prophets and his word, he was giving them faithful warnings, giving them a wake-up call. But what happened to Chronicles 36 and 16? "But they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people, till there was no remedy." A line was crossed. I wonder, do you ever think, unsaved person here, do you ever think about a line being crossed? Ever cross your mind? Rejecting Jesus last year, the year before, maybe for 20, maybe for 30 years, maybe for more. Never occur to you that a line might be crossed one day? There's an old hymn that says, "Over the dead line at last." Well, a line was crossed, and we read regarding that nation, there was no going back. Verse 17, "Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees," that's the Babylonian king, "who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young men or maiden, old man or him that stooped for age." This is God. "He gave them into his hand," into the Babylonians' hand. "And all the vessels of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king and his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia." With that in our minds, that was the chronicle, that's written down what happened. Let's read now in the book of Daniel and chapter 1 and verse 1. The book of Daniel, chapter 1 and verse 1. "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave," there's that phrase that we've just mentioned, "the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand," into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, "with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar," as an old name for Babylon, "to the house of his God, Nebuchadnezzar's God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure of the house of his God." How sad. The Lord gave his own people into the hand of their enemies, the Babylonians, a power greedy, looting and pillaging people who were also idolaters. What exactly had happened? Well, we read some of it, of course, in Chronicles there, but there was more than just the bit we read about them following the ways of the nations around about them. Because in verse 21 of 2 Chronicles 36, we read this here, "To fulfill the word of the Lord by the prophet Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths, for as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath, to fulfill 70 years. 70 years. Now notice this is not ordinary weekly Sabbaths that are in view here. These are Sabbaths relating to the land. So that what's happening in the book of Chronicles, it's describing that in the taking away of the people out of their land, the land was being given rest that it hadn't been given. And the reason it hadn't been given rest for many generations was the greed and materialism of the people. You see, there should have been one year in every seven, a Sabbath year. We talk about a Sabbath day, a Sabbath year, when the land was allowed to rest. It should lie fallow and recover its strength and be able to produce all the better in the years to come. This was part of God's law. And what we are reading in 2 Chronicles 36 is God saying, I'm going to tell you, if you won't listen to my word and do what I say, the land's going to get a rest for 70 years. But it's going to be at your expense. And I'm going to take you away from all the materialism that you accumulated by working that year that you shouldn't have worked, by grabbing and grasping. You know, there's many a broken-hearted Christian parent today who regrets working every hour that God sent to get, to have. Didn't spend much time with their wife, their family. And now they've regrets. Remember, a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things that he possesseth. There are greater riches than stuff. And this nation was paying the price. God said, this is what I want you to do. This is for your own good and the land's good. And the land is precious to God. If you miss that in reading the whole of your Bible, you've missed a great, great secret and truth. The land was precious to God, and they mistreated God's land, the promised land. And then they did all the other things that we have read of. You see, it's never just the action, is it? It's the motive behind the action. Judah had just casually set aside God's law to suit themselves. Their idea was, if it gets in the way of progress, let's just trample over it on our pathway to prosperity. What happens when a nation disregards God's law? Well, a long-suffering, gracious, loving, and merciful God eventually says, enough's enough. This period of time is so, so well documented. It's fascinating. The prophecies that God gave regarding this period of time before it happened are so precise and explicit. And yet, the people of that period, nationally, would not listen. Here's one such prophecy. Isaiah chapter 39, from verse 5. Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, he was a good king, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, said the Lord. And of thy sons that issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. That eunuchs there really just means servants, and we explain that a wee bit more fully when in our studies in the book of Acts we get to the Ethiopian eunuch. We'll explain that then. That's not all. That was Isaiah 39. Jeremiah 25 from verse 8. Thus saith the Lord of hosts. Now that's twice. Both of these prophecies, the title is the Lord of hosts. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, because ye have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the peoples of the north, saith the Lord. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, I will bring against them, against this land and against the inhabitants thereof. And this whole land, verse 11, shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity. and the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it a perpetual desolation. And Jeremiah 27, the beginning of verse 6, God speaking, and now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. That was well foretold, wasn't it? What happens when a nation disregards God's law? Well, the very enemies of God and God's people can become God's instruments. The word used there, servant. I have given them to these people. In that sense, these ungodly nations can be used by God to accomplish his purposes in the world, even in chastening his own people, his own called out elect people. What happens when a nation disregards God's law? Well, the discipline of God will have far-reaching consequences. For most, certainly, it will affect the perpetrators of the ungodliness. But also, most certainly, it will affect those who weren't guilty. We've said many times, God always had his remnant. He always had people after his heart, even in the worst of times. So they were going to be caught up in this as well. What a legacy. Because it wouldn't just be the perpetrators, but it would be their children and their children's children. What a legacy. We're not an island, are we? We just don't do actions and that stops with us. Sadly, the consequences are far-reaching. You know, the consequences of not praying, not gathering for prayer, they're far-reaching as well. Look around us, the whole society that where God has placed us. We think it's just us, it's just me. Don't feel like praying tonight. Don't feel like going. Far-reaching consequences. And God continues that distinction. It's not just those who were the true perpetrators who really distressed him and offended him, but in amongst them, good people would also be caught up in these captivities and this exile. And the Lord shows this by giving Jeremiah a vision of two baskets of figs. It's not one of the most popular stories that you'll hear. But Jeremiah sees these two baskets of figs sitting in front of the temple. One basket was full of good figs and the other was full of bad figs. And one of those words I think really hilarious in the King James, naughty figs. They're bad. Jeremiah 24 from verse 5. Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, like these good figs, so will I acknowledge them that were carried away captive of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans for their good. I will set mine eyes upon them for good. I will bring them again into this land and will build them and not pull them down, and I will plant them and not pluck them up. I will give them a heart to know me that I am the Lord, and they shall be my people. I will be their God, for they shall return unto me with their whole heart. And as the evil figs which cannot be eaten, they're so evil. Surely thus saith the Lord, so will I give Zedekiah the king of Judah and his princes and the residue of Jerusalem that remain in this land and them that dwell in the land of Egypt, and I will deliver them to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth for their hurt, to be a reproach and a proverb, a taunt and a curse in all places whither I shall drive them. So the Lord's taken into account, there's a lot in that, but breaking it down very simply, the Lord's taken into account a remnant who will have a heart for him, who will want to truly please him, who will have a desire after God. And God says, I'm going to meet that. Jeremiah 29 from verse 4. This is most interesting. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there's that phrase again, the God of Israel, unto all that are carried away captive and whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem unto Babylon. Listen to this. Build your houses. Dwell in them. Plant gardens. Eat the fruit of them. Take wives. Beget sons and daughters. And take wives for your sons. Here's generations coming in. That they may be increased there and not diminished. And seek the peace of the city, whither I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray unto the Lord for it. For in the peace thereof shall you have peace. Isn't that a strange one? I wonder how you and I would react if we were taken captive to somewhere completely alien to what we know here in Western Europe or even in Europe as a whole. Let's imagine we're taken captive into a Muslim country that's a Muslim state governed by Sharia law. Can you imagine that? Can you picture that? You didn't choose to go there. You've been taken there. A very different religious perspective, very strange traditions, and language, climate, everything about it. That's kind of what we're talking about here. But I wonder how you would react. How easy would you find it to seek the peace of that country? How easy would you find it to pray for that country? You know, the Lord has told us that we are to be salt in this world. Salt's to have a purifying effect because everything else has a putrefying effect, and we can see the putrefying effect of filth and stench around us, can't we? But we're to have the purifying effect. But God didn't say that's only to be for where you live in Northern Ireland. That's fine for there. Or some other country still just about by the skin of their teeth calling themselves a Christian country. No. To be the salt of the earth wherever God put us, even in Caesar's palace. God was saying to them, you're to make Babylon your home, but you're not to forget that it's not your home, because there's going to be a lapse of 70 years and you need to have that heart to return. I think about the little maid of Naaman's wife. She was salt, but she was captive. She'd been taken away from her people. She could have held her tongue. She could have rejoiced that her mistress's husband was dying with the cancer of its day, leprosy. But no. She spoke up and she said, there's a prophet in Israel, and sent them to Elisha. Yes, God has referred to Babylon as his servant. God is prepared to use the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, as his agent of judgment against Israel for their sins and their rebellion against him. You may have noticed in our readings there that we mentioned Zedekiah, but also Jehoiakim. And you're thinking, well, what king was it was the last king of Judah? And what king was it who was conquered? And well, this is where it's a wee bit more complicated, because they weren't just taken in one go. Now, they don't come back in one go either, but they weren't taken in one go. Whenever we read of Daniel and them, at the beginning of Daniel chapter 1, the first couple of verses, this is one of the first deportations. But there were several until Judah, the southern kingdom, was completely conquered. It was under the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar II that the Babylonian Empire really rose to its height in the Middle East. And at that time, Jehoiakim, king of Judah, king of the southern kingdom, was forced into submission because of their great power around him, you see. He became a vassal to Nebuchadnezzar. 2 Kings 24 and 1 tells us that. It was during that time that most of our exiles that we're going to look at were taken, the likes of Daniel, Hananiah, who's also called Shadrach, Mishael, who's called Meshach, and Azariah Abednego. After 3 years of serving Nebuchadnezzar, Jehoiakim of Judah rebelled. And he went to Egypt for support. Now, he was going against God's law in doing that. You know that. He shouldn't have gone to an alliance with a Gentile ungodly nation, but he did. So he was trespassing and trying to sort out a trespass by another trespass. That's how bad things were. After sending his army to deal with that, Nebuchadnezzar himself arrives to deal with the problem in Jerusalem around 597 or so BC. And he lays siege to Jerusalem. So this is another attempt. And Jehoiakim and his family and a number of the population, they are taken away at that point. Then after that, Nebuchadnezzar appoints King Zedekiah as his puppet king. So that's where his name comes in. As kind of representative under him in Judah. But after 9 years and still having not learned his lesson, Zedekiah, he tried another rebellion. And the Babylonians came in one final time. So this is how it happened in stages. But behind it all was still the sad, sad, sad truth that God was allowing it to happen because of the disobedience of his people. What happens when a nation disregards God's law? And yet amongst all of this, we read these words in Jeremiah 29 and 10. Thus saith the Lord, after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place. That prophecy was fulfilled. We'll get to that, of course, in due time. But in our introduction, it's good enough to say it at this point. In about 537 BC, when King Cyrus of the Medes and Persians, who conquered the Babylonians, when he allowed Jews to return to rebuild the city and the temple. And that took place in a couple of goes with Ezra and then Nehemiah. Thank you for bearing with me with some of those details. I hope it hasn't all been just like a lecture. But as we close, just one little thing. As we go through the book of Daniel, we're going to find terms like this. The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. Do you think has that changed? The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. We mightn't understand all that's going on, but we need to believe that today. We have plenty of boys. They're almost, it's becoming more and more totalitarian, becoming like dictators. We will have a dictator who will appear very soon, of course. The Bible calls him the Antichrist. But all of those people today who think they can even control the climate, all of those people have forgotten that the Most High still rules in the kingdom of men. Do you believe that? The name Most High appears about 13 times in the book of Daniel. Isn't that exciting? And here's a key phrase that I love. Daniel 2 and 28. There is a God in heaven. Amen. There is a God in heaven. So I think as we look through the exiles and ask questions, it'll not be as heavy in proof text as it was there this morning, that we will be encouraged for the days in which we live, that there is a God in heaven. May the Lord bless his word to all of our hearts for his name's sake.